This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. I'll start with a quotation from Goethe. He said, "I had the great advantage of being born at a time that was ripe for earth-shaking events, which continued throughout my life, so that I witnessed the Seven Years' War, the French Revolution, and the whole Napoleonic era, down to the defeat of the hero and what followed after him. As a result, I've attained completely different insights and conclusions than will ever be possible for people who are born now." Goethe's friend Johann Peter Eckermann recorded those remarks made by the great writer at the end of his life in a series of published recollections. Goethe's life was indeed remarkable. At the age of 25, he was author of the first German international bestseller, The Sorrows of Young Werther. A year later, he was invited by the Grand Duke to join him at the Imperial Court as Privy Councillor, where he oversaw commissions on war, roads and tax. He rode to war with the Prussian army against the French and embarked on a remarkable creative friendship with Schiller, which saw the establishment of a new form of German theatre. What made Goethe the dominant cultural icon of his time and after? What links were there between his interest in politics and the arts? Why did he support Napoleon, despite the French invasion of Weimar? And how was he able to transform the status of the German language? With me to discuss Goethe's life and work are Tim Blanning, Professor of Modern European History at Cambridge University, Sarah Colvin, Professor of German at Edinburgh University, and Dan Wilson, Professor of German at Royal Holloway University of London. Tim Blanning, what do we know of Goethe's family background and early years? He had a remarkably long life, born in 1749, died in 1832. But what about his early years and his family?
Well, Goethe was lucky enough to be born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He was born, as you say, in 1749 in the free imperial city of Frankfurt am Main, quite a large city by German standards, in the second division, I suppose, after Vienna, Berlin and Hamburg, but still by German standards, contemporary standards, a major metropolis with many cultural facilities. His father was wealthy from a patrician background. He owned one fortune in property, another fortune in bonds, and consequently could live the life of a rentier. He could organise his son's education in the best possible way. Goethe had the best education that money could buy. So from all those points of view, he's really born in the purple. He subsequently, in 1782, he was ennobled by the Duke of Weimar, Karl August. Goethe said that he didn't really pay any attention to that at all. He didn't set any store by it because, as he came from a patrician family in Frankfurt am Main, he felt himself to be the equal of nobles anyway. So Goethe's coming from a very comfortable, cultured, well-educated, urban, metropolitan even, Protestant background.
And which direction did his education take him into?
His education takes him, I think that's rather difficult to go into every possible detail. I think one thing I would like to pull out, though, which is very important for his subsequent life and for his works, is that he has a very thorough grounding in the Bible, in its Lutheran translation, in Lutheran theology, Because Goethe later, indeed at an early, a relatively early age, turned his back on Christianity or turned away from Christianity, it's easy to forget just how deeply embedded in his personal culture is Lutheran theology and, above all, the Lutheran Bible. That is one of the other great sources of the modern German language. Goethe himself has probably as important an impact on the development of the German language as, let us say, Shakespeare did on the development of English. But it's out of that Lutheran Bible, I think, that so much is coming.
And he became a scientist of considerable achievement as well. Was that developed in his adolescence, in his education?
Indeed it was. He has a wonderfully quick, accurate, observing eye. Everything Goethe sees, he sees it with a particularly penetrating gaze. And that comes through, I think, in pretty well everything he writes, but more especially in his poetry. And I think it's in a way it's important not to make too clear a distinction between his poetry and his science. He himself would not have made that distinction. They're part of the complete person. And so when he's looking for language in which to express his discoveries in nature, what we would call the natural sciences, it's expressed in a poetic way. And so one can go to his poetry as well as to his more formally scientific works to find those kinds of insights.
As a young man, Goethe affiliated himself with a movement called, I'm going to use the English, I haven't got German, Sturm und Stress. Can you tell us about that? Perhaps you could risk the German, but Sturm und Stress, I'm sure it sounds better in German. Sturm und Stress, what was it about and what was his role in that movement?
Well, for once it does sound better in German. Quite a lot of things do, believe it or not. But in German it's Sturm und Drang. And Sturm und Drang a more activist kind of sound than Sturm und Stress. Sturm und Stress is altogether too static, but Drang is a word which really means thrust, or it has that connotation of thrust. So it's very much a movement of thrust and storm and stress as well. It's a movement of the 1770s. It's short-lived. It can be best described, I think, as a movement of angry young men. These are all young men, those who are involved in it, Goethe and Herder and Klinger and Lenz and so on. They're young men who are in revolt against what they see as the stuffy old, over-rationalist, enlightened French classicism.
Sarah Colvin, can we take that on, that Sturm und Stress, did it appear in Goethe's early work, and how did he express the ideas in his work?
It appeared in his the play that made him famous, which was Götz von Berlichingen with the Iron Hand. And Götz is a play that really encapsulates all of the intentions of Sturm und Stress, Sturm und Drang. One of the things that the Stürmer und Dränge, the Sturm und Stress representatives, were doing was reacting against the kind of hegemony of French neoclassical theatre in Germany. And they wanted a theatre style that was more natural, more immediate. And one of their heroes was Shakespeare. And when Goethe writes Götz, he was 24 years old, very young, he's working in the style of Shakespeare, of a Shakespearean history play. And what does that mean? He's looking at the individual in society. He's looking at a civil war situation. Tim was talking about Luther, Goethe's awareness and admiration for Luther. He sets the play in the time of Luther, 16th century. Goethe is a 16th century knight who's under pressure from the expanding empire. And he resists that pressure. He's trying to maintain his local independence. One of the things the Sturm und Stress people were interested in was the fate of the individual in a kind of society and movement, and Goetz is certainly that.
And we have in that, for the time, an original character of a woman, a character who's original, a woman. Would you say that? Adelheid.
Adelheid is Goetz's counterpart in the play. I mean, as Tim was saying, Sturm und Stress is a boy's movement, a man's movement. And Adelheid, I think, is probably the least attractive woman character Goethe ever wrote. He claimed himself to be in love with her, but she's an extremely unattractive character. And what she represents is the forces of the courts. Goethe is, in fact, a very masculine play. The ideal of a kind of Germanic masculine hero is what Goethe is. And his counterpart, Adelheid, is an evil, scheming woman of the court who seduces Goethe's friend, takes him away, takes him to court, eventually poisons him. And is condemned to death at the end by a secret court, which also seems to be made up entirely of men.
Why do you think, then, that Goethe thought that he was in love with her?
It's something I've never understood. Goethe simply said that he himself was in love with Adelheid. She's a dreadful character.
The book, a year after he'd written the play, the book that made him famous was The Sorrows of Young Werther, a novel, which, like Byron, he woke up to find himself famous and so on. Can you tell us a little about that and why? What sort of fame it brought him? If you could just outline for those who don't know quickly the story, it's quite easy to outline. And then what sort of it did to him?
Yes, well, the story is easy to write, and it's a novel written in letters. That's important because that makes it very immediate. And it tells the story of a young man who falls in love with a woman who is engaged to another man. And it brought Goethe enormous fame. It was hugely successful. There are elements of Storm and Stress in it as well, but mainly it was tapping into the cult of sensibility, the importance of the heart, the importance of the emotions, and an enormous audience responded to that. It sold out very quickly for a little while. I think it was the best-known book in Germany after the Bible, The Sorrows of Young Werther. And it was popular for all kinds of reasons, you know, partly because of the cult of sensibility, also partly because it was taken to be a roman à clé, something that you could decode, and people loved that. They decoded it as Goethe in Wetzlar when he himself fell in love with a young woman called Charlotte von Buff. The main character that Werther falls in love with is called Lotte. That brought some embarrassment, actually, to the real Charlotte von Buff and her fiancé.
You haven't mentioned, sorry to be...
Go on.
The most important thing is that he kills himself at the end. And the most important thing in the book is that it's a class decision. Now, that he's snubbed by that. Now, we are told, you tell me if I'm right, that after that, a lot of young men either did or enough or contemplated taking their own lives in imitation of Werther. It had that sort of, that effect, as well as being widely read.
That's right.
And this actually sort of impinged on his life, this kind of fame, disturbed his place in society in a way.
It did. I mean, Werther was badly understood, misunderstood as a novel. I mean, firstly, because people didn't understand that Goethe was actually criticising the cult of sensibility in the character of Werther, who eventually commits suicide. And secondly, because it was read as an encouragement to suicide, which it certainly wasn't. It was partly Goethe dealing with the story of Karl Jerusalem, a young man he knew who'd committed suicide. And he rewrote the novel in 1787 to make readers more critical. I think Goethe was very disappointed in his reading audience when he wrote Werther, because they misunderstood him on so many counts.
That's a common feeling among writers, I've been told. Dan Wilson, in 1775, Goethe received an invitation from Duke Karl August, who was only 18, to join him at the Imperial Court of Weimar, which sounds very grand, and it was part of the Holy Roman Empire, but it was a state of 100,000 people, which can be grand enough. But how did that come about, and what did he do when he got there?
Well, at first he was not invited to be part of the government. He was simply invited to visit Weimar for the first half year, so it was not clear what role he would play there. And he was sort of a protege of the Duke. The Duke had just turned 18, so he just had become the Duke, Karl August, in, as you say, a territory that was very small. The city of Weimar itself numbered some 8,000 inhabitants, so it was really kind of a glorified village, and yet had a court and all sorts of culture that became very important. The Duke and Goethe was 26 at this point, so he was older than Karl August. And when they got to Weimar, there was a great deal of sort of carryings on by the two of them and some of their male friends. They sort of rode around in the countryside, scaring the peasants and pulling all sorts of tricks. This has generally been felt to be the reason for this. It's generally felt to have been that Goethe intended to gain the confidence of Karl August so that he could then have a beneficial influence on him, and this would benefit the entire duchy. On the other hand, Goethe seems to have been the ringleader, more or less, of this group. And there is some evidence that he was, from later conversations that Goethe had, that he was trying to make Karl August into a sort of natural, a more natural person by pulling him away from the court and sleeping with, this whole group would sleep out under the stars. And this sort of, so this was a kind of a project to make him into the kind of person that would be susceptible to the sort of positive influence.
And as I read it, this young man was dazzled by this brilliant intellectual and was hoping that he would attract other intellectuals from across the German-speaking Holy Roman Emperor. He encouraged Goethe to come into government, and he made him a privy councillor. As Tim said earlier in the programme, he ennobled him, which partly enabled, therefore, Goethe to eat at the top table instead of the middle table and be a diplomat instead of not being a diplomat. These things matter, and we mustn't forget that they did matter there. What effect did his duties, because he seems to have been very conscientious, lots of meetings and lots of tax collecting and lots of imposing of this, that and the other, what effect did his duties have on him and on his writing? Could you briskly tell us that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I should say that when this happened, when the Duke of Weimar appointed him to the highest government body in Weimar, what in English is often called the Privy Council, this was a huge scandal in Weimar because Goethe was very seriously underqualified for the position. He had studied law, but normally it would have taken maybe 20 years to reach a position like that. In any case, when it happened, though, Goethe really settled down. These sort of antics in the countryside stopped. And he really put his nose to the grindstone and worked very hard for essentially 9 years until the spring of 1785, doing practically nothing else. Now, he did write some shorter things, a lot of poems. He did write drafts of works, but these were not published in these 9 years. So basically the reading public gave up on him and figured he would never write again. He would never publish again. So it was very, very hard work. He treated some 11,000, over 11,000 different cases during those 9 years when he was privy councillor.
It's extraordinary that he gets himself involved in that detail. What sort of man did he turn out to be at the end? Was he a benevolent person or was he not?
Well, politically, it's very interesting because I think he had plans for reform when he entered this position. But I think that you'd have to say that the power corrupted him as much as it would have anyone in that kind of system where there really was no sort of control or little control. And there are areas where he did things that even in his own government were considered to
Can
be...
Can you give us an example of that?
One of the things, for example, since I'm an American and they're British here, we could use this example. They sold off inmates from the prison in Weimar to British recruiters for service in the war against the Americans. Now, this happened from the beginning of the American War right to the end, which was more or less the same period as Goethe's 9 years in that position.
And this was illegal?
It was illegal in Weimar law, and it was objected to by the judicial authority, and yet they went ahead and did it. Because, if someone had been put in jail for 7 years for theft, then transforming that into what amounted to, for many people, a death penalty was not foreseen in Weimar law.
Tim Branning, just briefly before we move on to from this, do you think that Weimar did, in that sense, as has been indicated by Dan Orson, corrupt him and take him away from what would be his bigger cultural or his cultural purpose?
I don't think I'd see it that way, and I don't think he saw it that way himself. One has to wonder why he went to Weimar, which, as Dan has said, was a small court in a small town in a small principality. The kind of explanation I like is the one offered by Nicholas Boyle in his great biography of Goethe, in which he points out that Weimar is geographically almost exactly halfway from Frankfurt am Main to Berlin. And so what Goethe is doing, he's moving out of Frankfurt am Main, a free imperial city, a self-governing municipality, but in his eyes, very conservative, very narrow, very Philistine. On the other hand, he doesn't want to go to a great big court like that of Frederick the Great in a great big city like Berlin, which would have all kinds of other problems, not the Philistinism. Frederick the Great's court was nothing, it certainly was not Philistine. So what he goes for is something in the middle, somewhere which is a court which has those kinds of cultural facilities like a theatre and so on and so forth, and which where he's going to get status as well, which he does, of course, but which doesn't have that kind of Philistine burger type culture that Frank von Meyen, which he referred to disparagingly. He told his mother subsequently that he wouldn't have stayed in Frankfurt am Main even if that invitation hadn't come along.
Sarah Colvin, in Weimar we have one of the most significant relationships with women. He has several significant relationships with women. This is, can you tell us about Charlotte von Stein?
Well, Goethe is famous for his relationships with women, and critics were always extremely interested. This is generally considered the most interesting. Charlotte von Stein was a lady-in-waiting to Anna Amalia, so to Duke Karl August's mother. When Goethe arrived in Weimar, she was 33. She was about 7 years older than he was. She'd been married for 12 years. She'd had seven children. Three of them survived. Common fate for parents in those days was losing children. And Goethe almost immediately became very close to Charlotte von Stein. He actually knew about her before he went there. He'd seen her picture. His friend Lafater, his Swiss friend, collected silhouettes, shadow silhouettes were very popular in that day, and made deductions about people's characters by looking at them. This was Lafater's science. And so Goethe had not only seen a picture of Charlotte von Stein, he'd also received a notion about what kind of a character she was.
And what happened between them then? I'm not asking for any... I'm not ferreting around. The fact is they had an interesting intellectual relationship. Well, that's what I want to get at.
Well, they did, yes. And I mean, what happened between them is one of the great questions that German studies battles with. Nobody knows whether there was a physical relationship between them. People have been very interested in that, but there is no evidence either way. It was certainly an intense intellectual relationship. Goethe wrote over the period he knew her well over 1,500 letters to Charlotte von Stein. But part of the problem is we don't have the letters she wrote back. They're lost. The story goes that Charlotte von Stein demanded them back from Goethe and destroyed them. Again, there's no evidence for that. We don't know who destroyed them. What he did do was send her his work. She read his plays. She was herself a playwright. That's something that often isn't mentioned about Charlotte von Stein. She was a writer. She was a very funny playwright, a very witty playwright. She lampooned Goethe in a couple of her plays. There was a very early one she wrote just after he arrived at court called Rino, where she just makes fun of the new arrival. And there's a much later one after their estrangement. They had quite a bad estrangement after Goethe ran off to Italy and didn't mention to Charlotte von Stein that he was going. Came back 2 years later and was terribly surprised that she didn't really want to talk to him anymore.
We haven't time really to dwell on Italy, but we have to mention it, Tim, because I want to move on quite quickly now. But he left for Italy without it appears telling anyone, not even Charlotte von Stein, with whom he had a close intellectual relationship, and the rest is unknown, so leave it at that. Had he just got fed up with being the administrator at Weimar, and he wanted to find... Because in Italy, he set out to be a painter, first of all, when he went to Italy, didn't he?
He did, that's quite
and
right.
And didn't make a bad shot of that either.
I don't think one has to cuddle one's brains too hard to decide, to determine why he went to Italy. Lots of Germans did. And indeed, his father had always planned that Goethe should go to Italy to complete his education as a part of a kind of intellectual grand tour. So he would have gone sooner or later, I think. Anyway, it turns out to be later rather than sooner. As you, I'm sure you know, I mean, the Germans have this kind of yearning for the South, the Drang nach Süden, the sort of the desire to get to the South. It crops up again and again in German literature, in Thomas Mann, for example, in Buddenbrooks. So I think it's part of that, and there's a kind of yearning for the South, for all that it represents. Indeed, one of the most famous lines in German poetry is that which begins, "Do you know the land where the lemon trees bloom?" That's a poem which comes in Goethe's Wilhelm Meister's apprenticeship. It's one of the most famous lines in German poetry. It's a kind of yearning for the South where everything is sunnier and things smell better and so on. So I think I'm sure that frustration with the day-to-day, the mundane existence and the 11,000 cases he had to try in Weimar had a lot to do with it, but it's not the whole story.
And he wrote Roman Elegies and he painted there, but he started to write there again. These were also considered at the time to be rather erotic poems, but he came back to Weimar, divested himself of a lot of his administrative responsibilities, as I understand it, Dan Wilson, and entered in a relationship with Christian Vulpius. Now, can you tell us briefly about that, and how, and it was very different from that with Charlotte von Stein, wasn't it?
Well, yes. Christiana Vulpius was from the lower classes, more or less, and she, they met sort of by chance. And right after he had come back from his first long trip to Italy. And the relationship was a scandal, really, because they lived together for many years in sin without being married, had a child after the first year.
Do you think he didn't marry because of the class difference? Because we haven't really touched on that, but it bubbles around his work very strongly. And so he is an Earl. He obviously wants to be an Earl. You could have said no. And away we go. I mean, but she is lower class, and she is not the letter writer that Sarah, an intellectual mm-hmm, Sarah, mm-hmm. was describing earlier of the other woman. What do you think that enters into?
Yes, probably.
Is that why he didn't marry as
probably.
Well?
Probably. I mean, I think there's not much evidence for that, but... certainly, you know, as Tim has said, he was himself a nobleman at this point. Interestingly, the scandal, I think, had wider repercussions than simply, you know, sort of a moralistic thing. Because if any of the other subjects of the Duke had dared to do this, they would have been hauled before the church authorities and been forced to either punished or been forced to recant, whatever. So I think people were scandalized also because it was seen as a sort of abuse of privilege on Goethe's part.
Tim?
This class consciousness, that's something we need to address. It needs to be brought out. In Werther, when we were talking about Werther, we didn't mention that. But there are several moments in Werther where Goethe really parades himself as an angry young man, kicking against the aristocratic pricks, no pun intended. For example, there's a moment when Werther goes to an assembly in the evening and is cold-shouldered by the aristocrats and then is asked by his friend the Count to leave. So this is something which I think Goethe felt really acutely in the 1770s. It may well be that power corrupted him at Weimar, and he becomes increasingly easy and more comfortable with aristocratic society. But I think it's still there. And it's there not just because it's, as it were, an intra-German thing, one, a German commoner feeling discriminated against by a German aristocrat. But there's also a cultural dimension to this, in that the aristocratic culture is associated with French domination. And so when a German like Werther adopts English dress rather than the Frenchified dress of the courtiers, and when he gets cross about discrimination at court, this is a blow not just against German aristocrats, but against the domination of French culture.
Let's go to his work now, Sarah, with you. He'd been working on his great drama, Faust, and the 1790, the first publication of the first edition came out. Mm-hmm. What drew him to Faust, and can you tell us what he added to the Faust story, which had been around in German folk tales and had been written about before?
Well, Faust takes us back again to the time of Luther. The very first German Faust book was published by Luther's publisher, and was just recorded a legend, really. And Goethe picked up that legend, which again was a very Germanic legend, like the Goethe story, a German theme for a German theatre, and ran with it. And he developed the legend quite radically. I mean, Marlowe had already picked it up and used it in England. I mean, Goethe didn't, in fact, read Marlowe's play till after he'd written his Faust one. But Goethe changes the story and adds things to it. He changes the ending radically. Marlowe's Faust is torn apart by devils. Goethe's is saved. He develops the episode with Helen of Troy. Faust marries and lives with Helen of Troy. And crucially, in Faust Part 1, he adds a completely new story where Faust meets a young woman called Gretchen. Seduces her, leaves her, she's pregnant, kills her baby when it's born because otherwise she risks enormous social shame, and is then put in prison and executed. So that's an addition by Goethe to the Faust story and a very famous one.
Was it received very well when it was first published? It's the greatest work of his that ever since rolls through.
Well, it is. You know, first he went to lots of incarnations. The 1790 publication was called A Fragment, and it was a number of scenes that Goethe had put together while he was in Italy, and brought them back and published them as a fragment. The Part 1, as we know it now, wasn't published till 1808, and Part 2 wasn't published until after Goethe died. And Part 2 was the bit that Goethe was most concerned about, in a way. He didn't actually want it opened until after his death. He wasn't really quite sure how it was going to be received. And Part 2 is extremely problematic and almost impossible to stage. It's very episodic, involves elephants on stage, all kinds of stuff. So by far the more difficult bit, and actually in Germany today and in Britain as well, if you're going to see Faust, what you tend to see is part one and not part two.
It's difficult to keep a balance because his life was so massive and his work was so massive. To keep the balance with the life and the work is quite a tricky operation. But let's go back to the life for a second. Dan Wilson, in 1792, Goethe joined the Prussian army, an expedition, into France to rescue the monarchy. In effect, he was a monarchy, anti-nationalist but pro-monarchist. What effect, what impact did that time as part of the army have on him?
Yes, he joined the Duke, who was the general of a Prussian regiment. That happened back then if you were related to the, especially if you were related to the Prussian family, which Carl August was. He joined him and was there in his official capacity as a sort of traveling privy counselor. It was a horrible campaign. Tim knows has worked on this. And some of the things that Goethe witnessed really shook him very deeply. Not only the hostilities, but also they were caught in rivers of mud, and there was horrible dysentery on the front, and they were finally forced to retreat. In some of the letters that Goethe wrote, you can really sense how deeply it affected him. But I'd have to say that even before that, before he directly experienced war, he wrote some things that were very, you might say today, pacifist. In the play Egmont, there's a passage where one of the characters warns against civil war and just sort of the real effect that it has on people. And even in 1792, when the war that had until then been simply a war between Prussia and Austria on the one hand and France on the other hand was declared a war of the empire against France, and therefore that Weimar was then at war with France, Goethe wrote very critically of that decision of his colleagues in the Privy Council. And he said, you know, years from now, people are going to look back and see that, that there would be another 30 years war coming for this. He was wrong in the number, but until 1815, Europe was at war, and he considered it a huge mistake.
Back to the work now, Sarah Colvin. Just before he went into France, he took up the directorship of the Weimar Theatre and became very, very close friends with Schiller, and they worked together and had ideas about a new German theatre. Can you tell us something about that, the impact of Schiller on Goethe and vice versa? What were they after that?
Well, it was an enormously important friendship. Goethe was the elder of the two. Goethe was 10 years older than Schiller, and Schiller had always admired him and been in awe of him. They made friends finally because Schiller really needed Goethe. Schiller wanted to produce a journal called Die Horen, The Graces, which was about establishing a German national literature. And this was the beginnings of what is called Weimar classicism, and Goethe and Schiller are the central figures in Weimar classicism. And it's classicism in the sense of 5th century Athens, I suppose. It's about establishing a nation, creating a nation. Not really nationalist in the way that we tend to think of that negatively to do with Germany these days. I mean, Germany at that time, you're very fragmented.
There wasn't a Germany as there was in England.
Precisely. Yeah. What there was a collection
of states.
Lots of states
which were part of the Holy Roman Empire. Yeah.
And what Goethe and Schiller wanted to create was a German literature that enabled those states to come together, that was also aware of what was going on abroad. It was never intended to be exclusive. But also, you know, as Tim was saying, the French neoclassical influence, the hegemony of French culture, also Italian culture, the courts were playing Italian opera, French theatre. There wasn't really anything culturally German. And the same was happening with music in the 18th century, trying to establish something culturally German. That's what Goethe and Schiller were looking to do.
I think this is very, really very, very important that Goethe and Schiller are, when they look at Germany, they don't see a country which is fragmented so much, although I think one could use that. That's an obvious adjective to use. They see a Germany which is more polycentric, which has lots and lots of cultural centres. So Goethe, again, when talking to Eckermann late in life, looking back on a Germany which has been much simplified by the peacemakers of 1815, he sees the fact that Germany is divided into all kinds of different states as a positive advantage. And he says, well, where else in Europe will you find 20 theatres, 20 opera houses, 100 public libraries? We have that because we have no one capital. And when he wants to look for a counterexample, he says, look at France. There is Paris. Paris is France. France is Paris. And he's sucked all the blood out of the provinces, which are dead. And he may have been wrong about that, but that was something which he believed. So he advocated this polycentralism of Germany as something which was a real benefit and which should be protected. They're cultural nationalists, but in political terms, they would like to see it decentralized still.
Yes, that's very true and very important, I think. Even at the very beginning of his relationship with Karl August, when Karl August came to Frankfurt and sought Goethe out, they discussed this, apparently. At least there was a copy of a book by Justus Mörser, who was a political writer who favored the smaller principality, the system in Germany that supposedly protected freedom and the smaller principalities. And along with this, it's important to note, I mean, I've pointed out some of the negative aspects of the political Goethe, but next to his pacifism, or what one could, at least antipathy to war, one should mention his antipathy to the new nationalism in Germany. He did not want, when in 1813 there was an uprising against against Napoleon, he really was very opposed to it and ostentatiously wore the Legion of Honor medal that Napoleon had bestowed on him. So that, for that reason, it's been difficult for nationalists throughout German history to adopt Goethe as one of their own.
I want to come to Napoleon, but Sarah Colvin, you want to get in.
Well, later in life, Goethe developed a concept he called world literature, and his concept of literature was always about crossing boundaries, and he was particularly interested in France and Britain and Germany, but literature was always about crossing boundaries, and certainly in the theatre in Weimar, Goethe and Schiller put on international plays, not just German plays. But also what's important is that their conception of art was as something that could educate politically and socially, that art and the theatre were alternative spaces where in this Europe that was suffering war and uproar, people could kind of retreat into this other space, experience balance, harmony, education, and then carry that back into society and develop civic society through art.
We must remember, as Dan Wilson pointed out, that we're in a period of incredible turmoil. I mean, this country that we're in at the moment was seriously shaken and terrified that Napoleon would get here. And Europe was... It was a great fight going on all over the place, and it was a fight to do with monarchy, a fight to do with... obviously to do with territorial power, but a fight to do with economic... and so on. So I want to bring Napoleon in here quickly, Tim Blanning, because Goethe was anti-nationalist and probably one of the greatest nationalists, well, one of them, Napoleon. Napoleon invaded Weimar, and curiously, Goethe's mistress, who became his wife, stood outside the house, we're told, and defended the house. What he was doing inside, I can't work out, but there you go.
He wasn't there.
And yet, he met Napoleon. Napoleon admired him, as everybody seemed to do, gave him a decoration which he wore till his dying. What was going on there between Goethe and Napoleon?
Well, I think the secret to Goethe's very obvious admiration of Napoleon is his disapproval of the French Revolution. Goethe disapproved of the French Revolution from the very start. His friend Schiller turns against the revolution only in 1792 after the September massacres, and then turns against it big time, incidentally. But Goethe, right from the start, disapproved of the French Revolution, was opposed to it root and branch. So when Napoleon takes power in 1799 and appears to close down the revolution, to solve the domestic problems, to put an end to the anarchy and the bloodletting and so on and so forth, Goethe very
he
much
just
admires
becomes a world dictator instead. Yeah.
Exactly so. Yes, I think
Goethe out to be, anyway.
seriously misjudged Napoleon, one of the great criminals of world history. But never mind. That's one thing. The other is, I think, of course, that Napoleon flattered him, and Goethe, being a human being, liked being flattered a great deal. Goethe, when they met in 1808, Napoleon told him that he'd read Werther 7 times, that it was one of the books he'd taken with him on his expedition to Egypt, and he gives him the cross of the Légion d'Honneur, and Goethe likes
that? I think that has quite a lot to do with it too.
Dan Wilson.
I just wanted to add to that. His opposition to the revolution didn't prevent him, however, from understanding that the elites in France had brought the revolution on themselves. He said that more than once, that that it's the irresponsibility of the powerful that caused this event. And therefore, German princes should learn from this example. I mean, there was a widespread opinion in Germany that they should sort of clean up their act and introduce reform so that they could avoid the same fate. But it really was an important event in Goethe's life, a really traumatic one. And everything he wrote practically from the beginning of the revolution in 1789 until the late 1790s dealt in some way or another with the revolution. And even his friendship with Schiller can be seen as a sort of, as aimed partly. The two of them wrote invective against their political critics, who were generally opposed to their conservative views.
Sarah Colvin, briefly, can you tell us what his legacy is in terms of his portrayal of women?
Well, I mean, there's a real-life Goethe and a literary Goethe, and the real-life Goethe is very often and quite rightly criticised for his treatment of women, and he wasn't at all supportive of women writers, not a bit. He and Schiller didn't really think that women had it in them, and made that perfectly clear. On the other hand, the literary Goethe is fascinating in his portrayal of women. He writes his play Iphigenia, a version of the Euripides play, and shows us a woman who first of all tells us what a hard life women have because they're constrained in the domestic sphere, you know, as they were also in the 18th century, as Goethe very well knew, and then launches with the play a kind of critique of masculine politics and masculine rhetorics with which his Iphigenia breaks through at the end and tells the truth and saves the day. And in Faust is saved at the end by a figure of the eternal feminine, which has caused havoc in scholarship because people don't know quite what it means. And it's sometimes been taken to mean the rather clichéd notion of the ideal woman who lets men off the hook of behaving well because she's doing it for them. But on the other hand, you could also see the eternal feminine as a great kind of opposite pole, again, to male politics, masculine discourse, male rhetoric, and a space of aesthetic education.
Well, we're coming to the end of the programme, unfortunately. We'll have to miss out all the science, which is a bit of a nuisance. We can do Goethe the Scientist some other time. But finally, Tim Blanning, what would you say, what is his, we could use the word German cultural icon, a force that set German culture on its better path. How would you sum it up, him up, if you could?
Well, I can sum it up best by quoting former colleague of mine, Ernest Gellner, who was professor of social anthropology in Cambridge, and he liked to quote a line from A Penny Dreadful by James Hadley Chase, which runs as follows. Every girl should have a husband, preferably her own. And then Ernest went on to say, and every nation should have a culture, preferably its own. And that's where Goethe comes in. The Germans wanted a culture. They wanted their own. They wanted their great writer, who was as great as Dante, as great as Shakespeare. And in Goethe, they found him.
And was he someone that people clustered around from then on, or have clustered around, have found as an example?
Yes, he's been reinvented by every succeeding generation of Germans.
Well, thank you all very much. Sorry about the science, Dan. We could have talked a lot about that. Dan Wilson, Sarah Colvin, and Tim Blanning. And next week I'll be talking about the Oxford Movement. Thank you very much for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast. You can find hundreds of other programmes about history, science and philosophy at bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.